This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. Registered dietitian Susan Kundrat is with us this afternoon. She joins us once a month, usually on the first Monday of the month, to talk about diet and nutrition. So if you have questions about diet, nutrition, give us a call and talk to Susan. The numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Susan Kundrat is a sports and wellness nutritionist and the owner of Nutrition on the Move. She specializes in developing personalized nutrition plans for athletes and the general public. She's an adjunct lecturer with the Food Science and Human Nutrition Department at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. She's a frequent contributor to magazines on health and fitness, and she's the author of 101 Sports Nutrition Tips. You'll find her on the web at www.nutritiononthemove.net. Questions about diet and nutrition are invited this afternoon. Again, those phone numbers, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Good to see you again.
Good to see you, Celeste.
How are you?
Very good. Thank you.
I am well myself, and we're going to talk this afternoon about antioxidants, and to say that maybe in a more inviting way, we're gonna talk about fruits and vegetables, I do believe, primarily.
Right.
Because that's what they contain, among other things.
Well, you do hear a lot about antioxidants, and it can be confusing. Basically, I think what we're looking at with nutrition, I mean, it's a very exciting time with nutrition and research in nutrition because we're really going beyond. We call this kind of going beyond basic nutrition when we think about functional food components or particular components in food that might be doing more than your basic vitamins and minerals. And antioxidants seem to be the, you know, a category of those components that may help decrease risk of disease and have been linked to decrease in risk of a lot of diseases, including things you might hear about lutein and zeaxanthin. Those are just names, fancy names for some of these antioxidants that are found in things like kale, for example, that we think play a role in decreasing, perhaps decreasing the risk of macular degeneration or enhancing eye health, and also been linked to decreased risk in some of these foods with cardiovascular disease, cancer, Alzheimer's, immune dysfunction, cataracts even. And so the whole thing we're finding is that maybe increasing the amounts of foods that contain these antioxidants, as you mentioned, particularly colorful fruits and vegetables, may down the road decrease our risk of certain diseases. So another good reason, I guess, to eat your fruits and veggies.
Yeah, and this is a great time of the year to do it because we have such a bounty of them, whether they come from your backyard or the farmer's market or the supermarket.
Exactly, exactly. It's a matter of really getting back to thinking about balanced eating. And it may sound simple, but that's really where it ends up going, is trying to make sure your plate's pretty well balanced and you've got a lot of different colorful fruits and veggies there so that you can get these extra benefits. I always get the question from people, well, can I just take a supplement instead, or can I just take some of these powdered forms of fruits and vegetables? Is that the same? And no matter what we do, we know that those things might be helpful too, but it's not really the same as getting in the fruits and vegetables, and what we're finding may be the synergistic effects of eating the actual food, because there are a lot of different things in the food itself besides just, for example, vitamin A or vitamin C. We might have all these other nutrients that tend to work together to keep us healthy. And so eating whole foods really does need to be the base of what we're trying to do.
Yeah. Well, when you said that you wanted, this is something you wanted to talk about this afternoon, I did a little work, a little research, and there are a number of organizations, including the American Heart Association, that recommends that you go to the foods to get these antioxidants. And according to the American Heart Association, they say, we don't recommend using antioxidant vitamin supplements. So go to the produce, go to the fish also, right?
Correct? Right, exactly. You know, and what it's kind of coming to is maybe thinking about yourself and what your risk factors are. If you have high risk of heart disease in your family, You may be thinking, well, we know vitamin E is probably important for cardiovascular health. There's still a lot of confusion over whether or not, and a lot of people disagreeing over whether or not to supplement with vitamin E. But we do know that if you eat more nuts and seeds and oils like olive oil that are high in vitamin E naturally, that's a good thing. We know that is beneficial, mm-hmm. and that is helpful. So those are things that you might say, gosh, I'm going to do that. I'm going to try to get more whole grains because they tend to be related to decreased risk of cardiovascular disease, and then also looking at more fruits and vegetables. But I've had a lot more questions lately from people either just coming into my office or calling and asking about even things as specific as eye health and saying, well, I've got some beginning macular degeneration, or we've got that in the family. Are there things that I could eat that might be helpful? And you can say, well, gosh, we don't think these are curative foods, but we know having more things like, again, spinach, citrus fruits, even eggs, because in the egg yolk, there's a lot of lutein and a lot of zeaxanthin and these certain antioxidants that we think are protective and maybe get to the macula of the mm-hmm. eye and can be beneficial that way.
Well, we've got a listener who wants to talk with us, so we're going to take that call in just a second. But before we do that, let's talk really briefly about serving size and how many servings a day are we looking at these days in terms of what's recommended.
Mm-hmm. Well, we do try to get in at least two cups of fruits, particularly fresh fruits, and 3 cups of vegetables a day. That would be ideal to try to get that in. Of course, we can eat more than that. You know, you think if you have a spinach salad, you could easily get 3 cups of mm-hmm. vegetables right there in one salad. So we do know the more the better, but maybe at least trying to get in what might be, for example, a big orange could be a cup right there, and maybe you're getting in a cup of strawberries. That would be kind of a minimum of trying to get in on the fruit end. And like I tell a lot of my clients, really, if you don't get many vegetables during the day, really consider having 2 or 3 veggies with your dinner meal at night, because again, that might be easy to have something like a salad and then steam. You know, asparagus has been really good even in the grocery stores lately, so maybe you steam asparagus and have a salad and you're getting 3 or 4 cups of vegetables at your dinner meal at night. Not everybody can eat that quantity of food, but even if you're looking to watch your weight, that's not many calories at all, because mm-hmm. of course they're so low in calories, most veggies. So maybe shooting for that 5 cups total of volume of produce a day is a good place to start.
Okay, let's take a call now for registered dietitian Susan Kundrat. A listener is waiting for us in Champaign on line 1. Hi.
Hello.
Hi there.
A couple questions for you. I have it's a homemade soup that I make that's, I call it 1-3, because it's a pound of this and 3 pounds of that and so on and so forth. And onion, green onion, bell pepper, potatoes, carrots, turnip. I usually use this to use up leftover turkey and things like that, so on and so forth. Cut everything into little bits, so I just have to bring it to a boil, and that's all the more cooking is needed. So I was wondering if you could talk a bit about how cooking affects the vitamin contents of all this stuff. Oh, and I put barley, I cook barley separately and sometimes brown rice and add that in, carrots, of course, and things. Lots of veggies, you know, it's very substantial.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good.
But I'd like to know how the cooking process affects the vitamin content of the ingredients I'm using, and I would also like to know if there's some way, or if you could tell us if there's some place I could send a sample of this concoction and have it analyzed for, you know, nutrients and fat and calorie content and so on and so forth. I'll listen offline. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call this afternoon.
Okay, well, first of all, that sounds quite nutritious and delicious. It sounds very good. To answer your question about the cooking technique, different foods react differently to heat, for example, and being cooked in fluid. And we know as a general rule, trying to eat many of your fruits and vegetables, particularly vegetables, fresh or lightly steamed is probably best. So, for example, if you lightly steam broccoli for a minute in a steamer and it's not really in touching the water, that's a good way to do it. If you don't eat it fresh, you can try it that way and cooks it a little bit, but not so much that you're going to lose a lot of nutrients. The thing about a soup, particularly if you're not cooking it all that long, it sounds like you're doing the exact thing that you should do, because certainly with not cooking it very long, the vegetables are staying relatively crisp. They're not really being heated all that long, but you're also eating the liquid. And that's what a lot of people don't do when they cook vegetables in liquid, then they discard that, and that's where a lot of the nutrients go. So when you have a soup like this, you're probably not losing that many nutrients because even some that might get oxidized in cooking, you're still eating or drinking the fluid or eating the fluid. So that's a great thing about soups. So it sounds like the way you're cooking or making the soup is great in that you would maybe go ahead and do the barley first or the brown rice or those things that take a long time and then put them in so that maybe it is just a few minutes that you're boiling everything and making them a lot more crisp. So I would say you're probably maximizing the nutritional value of what you could do for a soup. So that sounds great. Otherwise, you'd eat them fresh, really, besides the way that you're doing that. You can actually do a nutrition analysis yourself if you'd like to. I can give you a website for that. The website that I use a lot is one that was developed here by Jim Painter and some other folks at Illinois, and it's the nutrition analysis tool. It's www.nat.uiuc.edu. And that's nutrition analysis tool. You can get on there. You can put in all the ingredients for a recipe, and you can analyze that free online if you wanted to do that. If you didn't want to do that, I'm sure I would have a willing student. You could send it to me in my office at Strawberry Fields who would do the analysis for you. We could give you a breakdown of that because that's a lot of times what my students do. They might analyze different things for me, and they need experience doing that. So if you'd feel more comfortable doing that, you could drop it by. Because it is interesting to kind of get an idea to see what you're taking in. Now, this is just such a great example of a way where you can eat more vegetables. Because if you do put them in a soup, you often can eat more. Another thing you could do, even if you didn't want to go to all that trouble of making a big thing of fresh soup like you're doing, is even if you buy a canned vegetable soup or something. Sometimes I'll buy a canned Progresso or Healthy Choice or some type of, you know, natural soup, and then I might chop up fresh veggies and just put them in there for another minute or two, and they might be crisp, but they're part of that soup. You can make that soup even better by adding more fresh veggies to that, or even some flash frozen veggies, just quickly frozen veggies that are still pretty healthy nutritionally, just to boost the nutrition in that. But this sounds like a fantastic recipe.
Yeah. And there are some foods that actually, as I understand it, benefit either from the addition of a little fat or from cooking or processing. Tomatoes come to mind.
Exactly.
Right?
Tomatoes for sure. The lycopene in tomatoes, much more concentrated, much more available if tomatoes are actually cooked. And so that's why we say canned tomatoes or tomato sauce or tomato paste or something like that is really, really high. It wasn't that long ago that we would see all the ads about ketchup being so good for you. Well, it is high in lycopene, but you'd have to eat a lot of it. You'd have to probably the sugar and the sodium might outweigh the benefit of the lycopene on that angle. But definitely when it's cooked and processed, tomatoes tend to be really high in lycopene, more so than fresh. Yeah. And like you say, adding a little fat, we know that lycopene, for example, gets absorbed better if there's a little olive oil in a pasta sauce or something. So that's another thing to keep in mind. Maybe having a little bit of turkey or a little bit of meat or some tiny bit of fat in here might help you absorb some of the nutrients in there.
Okay, very interesting. So a variety of food, cooked a variety of different ways, and you're in pretty good shape.
Exactly. Right. I think people shy away sometimes from getting canned fruit or canned vegetables or frozen vegetables, or, you know, are afraid they're cooking them too long. And I think the big picture tells us that no matter how you eat them, they're going to be helpful for you. And sometimes it's just really, you know, more cost effective to buy some things that are frozen or canned, and that's fine. And that's where it really helps to be buying food in season. You can really see that at the farmers markets when you can see, boy, when those peppers go four for a dollar or something. And I always go kind of crazy at that time because you think, wow, this is such a good deal. And sometimes just buying a ton of those and cutting them and freezing them because they're not going to be at that price very long. Looking at what food is available different times and try to stay on that schedule, that's very helpful convenience-wise and also from a cost standpoint.
Our guest this afternoon here in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine is registered dietitian Susan Kundrat. She's a sports and wellness nutritionist and the owner of Nutrition on the Move. She's also an adjunct lecturer with the Food Science and Human Nutrition Department at the University of Illinois. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions about diet and nutrition. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take another call now. A listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi. I have some questions about oils. Okay. Now, I know that olive oil is very healthy and also very flavorful. It comes at a lot of different prices. Okay. So I also I stir fry things or saute, and I'm unclear if olive oil is a low temperature oil and really you shouldn't use it for stir frying, and if that's accurate, then what oil should be used?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah. So it's two questions there.
Okay, good. Well, I think with olive oil, we know it's healthy no matter what type you use, but generally the extra virgin olive oil, which sometimes is more expensive, may be a little bit better too. The other thing with olive oil is really how fresh it is. So you do want to make sure that you're using fresh olive oil. One thing I do is I don't buy the huge bottles. I buy smaller bottles and buy them more frequently because if it's open and closed and open and closed, then it can get oxidized more and turn rancid faster and those kinds of things. So you might want to think of the size that you're buying, which sometimes is not as cost effective if you're buying more smaller bottles, but depending upon how much you use. But that's what I would...
How fresh is fresh? Does it stay fresh if it's closed?
Well, it generally does, but the older it is, the less fresh it is. So usually you can...
Are you talking about you don't want it open for more than 2 months? Or more than 2 weeks,
Well, that may vary depending upon how, the olive oil was processed, too. Generally, you can tell by smelling it. I mean, if it doesn't smell good, you need to get rid of that. But the other thing, sometimes people don't realize with oils and other things, as simple as, similar to orange juice or something, if you keep it open for a while, some of those nutrients get oxidized. So you sort of want to use it and then close it off. And that way make sure that you're not having it open to air. But you have brought up a really good point with the temperature factor too. Olive oil tends to work really well if you're cooking quickly or if you're not heating it to real, real high temperatures. But if you are going to stir fry a little bit longer things, you might want to consider canola oil or another oil that tends to work better at higher temperatures.
So canola is okay for higher temperatures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, canola generally works better for higher temperatures. Okay. And you can usually tell because if you're cooking something or sauteing something and you get to that, what we call the smoke point or to a point where it's smoking and it doesn't smell too good, then you've gone too far. But So your best bet, just from a nutrition standpoint too, is to try to cook things the least amount of time you can. If it's not sitting in it very long. But I usually use olive oil more for things that don't get as hot. I'm roasting something or like maybe olive oil on vegetables to grill, fine. But if I'm going to stir fry for a longer period of time, I might use something like canola oil.
Okay. That helps me perfectly. Thank you so much.
Thanks
You're very
for
welcome.
Call.
Next we go to Terre Haute, Indiana, line 4. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Quick question about vitamin D. You're seeing a lot of articles about the importance of vitamin D. As a matter of fact, my multivitamin I'm taking out was raised from 400 to 1,000. I guess it's UI or something. Mm-hmm. I was wondering what your expert feels about vitamin D and its importance. One article I said it should even be considered more of a hormone than a vitamin. And what are the benefits and are there any downsides to mega doses of vitamin D. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Hang up and listen.
Very good.
Well, it certainly has been in the news a lot. We've talked about it here, too, because you're seeing more and more things on vitamin D all the time. I guess I would say one thing first, and that would be if you haven't had your vitamin D levels checked before adding a lot of extra vitamin D in a supplement, I would ask to have your D levels checked, and your physician can do that. I had mine checked recently. We find particularly in this area of the country where we don't get as much sun, we might go all winter without much sun and being able to make vitamin D in the body, that many people are very low. And if you are low, then even 1,000 IUs of vitamin D a day is not going to be near enough to bring your levels up. And so if you're concerned about it, I would first do that because many, many more people are getting those levels checked. And if you do need additional vitamin D, it might be 10 times this amount or 20 times this amount that you would need to bring your levels up. So that would be the first thing, because you don't really want to self-diagnose without knowing what your levels are. But as a general rule, in terms of good health, we are seeing the amounts being moved up to 800 IUs or 1,000 IUs a day just for general health from 400. And so you're finding, as you mentioned, a lot of multivitamins are boosting that, maybe doubling the amount, just because we're finding maybe the amount that we originally recommended wasn't enough just for general health to begin with. And so I think that people who are low are going to need a lot more than this, and most researchers are agreeing with that. So the thing that I would do with vitamin D is I would consider, what are you getting from food, first of all? Are you using milk products that might be vitamin D fortified, or other foods that are vitamin D fortified? Many foods that have calcium added also have vitamin D added. So for some people, they can get a good 600 or 800 IUs in food. And then also thinking about, yeah, if you take a multivitamin, does that have it in it? Probably should. Or if you take calcium, it should, because it helps absorb calcium. And take an inventory, I guess, is what I would suggest first, to see what you're getting possibly from food as well as supplements. I mentioned that nutrition analysis tool that you can do online if you are online. And you can plug that in and get an idea of your vitamin D intake from a daily, typical daily intake of your food as well. But I think from a standpoint of health, we know it's important for bone strength. I certainly have had athletes I've worked with who've been eating well, doing everything with calcium, but they haven't gotten enough vitamin D. Their vitamin D levels were so low that it didn't matter how much calcium they were taking in, they were not going to lay down strong bone. They were continuing to have stress fractures. So we know from a bone standpoint, it's as important as calcium, or certainly needs to be there. And also from certain cancers, we know with a reduction in certain cancers, maybe with better vitamin D status, and many things that are really being popped up with vitamin D. So it is one of those vitamins. You know, for quite a while ago, we thought vitamin A status was low in everyone and people were supplementing that. We found that that wasn't the way to go with supplementation. But with vitamin D, again, if it is low, it's really a clinical issue. So it is something you want to discuss with your doctor and see where your levels are to begin with, I would suggest.
Okay, very good. What's the current RDA? Is it 1,000?
It's actually moved up. It was 400 and now moved up to 800 and maybe 1,000. So there are different groups that are recommending different amounts now. And so I think we're still kind of in a flux to see where that shakes out.
Let's take another call now. A listener in Des Plaines, Illinois. Line 2, hi.
Oh, yes, hi. I did want to ask a question. Recently diagnosed with arthritis, and I was wondering if there's a list of bad foods so I can avoid them with that sort of a condition.
Well, I don't know that there's a list of bad foods necessarily. There is some thinking that high saturated fat can maybe cause damage in the body. So let's say if you're eating a lot of fried foods, a lot of greasy foods, those kinds of things, that actually might hamper arthritis, might cause more problems. We do know with arthritis that certain foods may be beneficial. So that might be where you want to put your focus, is things like, for example, cherry juice has been researched, that tart cherries or bright cherries and the actual 100% cherry juice might decrease inflammation in the body. So that may be helpful with arthritis.
Berries good and for this condition also?
Well, berries are good in general because they're high in the antioxidants and they may be helpful, particularly things like blueberries and strawberries. They're not, as far as I'm aware of, they maybe haven't been studied as much as these cherries have been studied. Things like the good fats, in other words, we talked about salmon or fatty fish, omega-3 fatty acids. Maybe even in your case, that might be where maybe even supplementing with an omega-3 fatty acid, depending upon what you're taking in, 1 to 3 grams has been shown to be beneficial in some studies with arthritis because of its strong anti-inflammatory properties, and it's hard to get enough of that in the diet. So that might be something that's beneficial too. And in general, again, just talking about more fruits and vegetables we think are beneficial just because they are high in the antioxidants and they may help repair cells in general. You know, and the other things that we think about with arthritis are really trying to make sure that you're continuing, as you probably know, continuing to move, continuing to try to be active when you can. So you're strengthening your muscles,
yeah,
which takes some pressure off the joints. If you're able to stay strong and fit, too, then we know that that's helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, that's great. I had heard about different things, but I'm not from someone with your background, so I'm pleased to hear it, and I'll make that part of the diet from now on.
Sounds good.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Next, we take a call from a listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, I'm calling about magnesium. I was just sort of checking it on the web, and they said it's lots of people have a deficiency in it. I guess I'm wondering why it's not listed on as one of the minerals on food products, and how much you need and what form, and if you're taking calcium supplements, should you also be taking magnesium supplements?
Okay. With magnesium amounts, you don't hear as much about magnesium as you do other things. Magnesium is often a part of some calcium supplements, although it's not in all of them. You'll find it in some calcium supplements or some bone health supplements, along with vitamin D. Sometimes vitamin K is added to that. The tolerable upper level for magnesium, and this is where a lot of supplements maybe are a little too high, is 350 milligrams a day. So even if you do supplement with that, probably you don't want to go over the supplemental dose of 350 milligrams a day. So magnesium, we know, is important for a lot of things, important for bone health, but it's also, if you think of a lot of other reactions in the body, magnesium is helpful with that. And so I would say with magnesium, it's not something, I don't know in terms of, you know, the exact, you know, amount that you're taking in as far as what type of magnesium it is. I don't know that I've read a lot about the differences in that if you take a magnesium supplement in general. I'm looking at a list here, too, of just foods, mm-hmm. you know, as far as where you
sources.
Find where you find magnesium. And if you look, for example, a cup of spinach, a cup of raw spinach has about 150 milligrams of magnesium right there. So it's very high. Beans are pretty high. Black beans, a half a cup is about 60. If we think about magnesium with a supplemental form, you know, the amount that's recommended not go over in a supplement is very similar to the amount that we recommend a day, which is about the 400 milligrams. So in other words, it's not one of those supplements that you'd take a ton in a supplemental form. It's best to get it, most of that, in your
food,
diet.
Yeah.
Right. And that's probably why we don't see as much of it as saying, gosh, do we need a lot of extra, like maybe vitamin D or
vitamin
C?
It sounds like it's pretty easy to come by.
Right. In a general basic diet, it's pretty easy. A couple other foods, a baked potato has 55. An ounce of peanuts has 50. Brown rice has 42. So even milk, a cup of milk has almost 30 milligrams of magnesium. So many people are going to get that 400 milligrams a day.
Pretty easily.
Right. And that's actually the male RDA. Women, it's about 310. So you look at that difference, and typically most people can get that in the diet, which is probably why we don't hear as much about it. There have been studies on cardiovascular disease. Maybe is it helpful with taking more in? But usually those supplemental forms are still around 350 or 400 milligrams a day.
Problems with toxicity?
There certainly could be. And I think that's why the recommended intake from supplements is very high. Right.
Relatively speaking.
Anytime we have a tolerable upper limit that's not very high like this one, then you certainly, you know, worry that there might be toxicity. So I think I wouldn't really go crazy about supplementing with magnesium. Usually because it's involved in so many processes in the body, it's something that you want to try to get throughout the day anyway, which would be primarily from food. There are some cases, and I'm checking a few things here, hypermagnesemia, which is high magnesium in the body, can be, you know, problematic in some people, particularly if they've got some kidney disease to begin with. You know, can cause some nausea, low blood pressure, some other things. And so from a standpoint of supplementation, it seems like a smaller amount, or maybe, again, not over that 350 milligram level is probably smart.
Let's take another call now for registered dietitian Susan Kundrata, listener in Champaign, on line three. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead.
Hello?
Hello?
Yeah. My question is, first of all, would you kindly give that website that you gave earlier a little bit? I missed it somehow.
Sure. Sure. Okay. And I'm going to ask this listener to turn his radio down, and then we'll get back to him. So in the meantime, we'll give the website again, Susan.
And that is www.nat.uiuc.edu. And you can also Google Nutrition Analysis Tool. That's what it's called, and you'll be able to find that as well.
Okay, let's go back and see if we have a follow-up from that listener in Champaign, line 3. Hi.
Yeah, hi. Would you kindly give that website that you gave earlier? I missed it.
We did it. We just did it, but we'll do it again. It's www.nat.uiuc.edu. And Susan also recommended if someone else is interested in this and they don't have pen and paper at hand, you can Google or put into your browser nutritional. Is it nutritional?
Nutrition analysis tool.
Nutrition analysis tool. Okay.
Oh, nutrition analysis tool. Okay.
Very good.
And this is NAE, right?
NAT.
Okay. And like Nancy?
N as in Nancy. A as in Adam.
Right.
T as in Tom.
Oh, T and Tom. Okay, N-A-T. Okay, thank you. Other quick question is, you know, like in diet, especially for people with high cholesterol or had heart problems, heart attack and so on, what would you recommend in particular for increasing the HDL level? And at the same time, what would you recommend for decreasing the LDL level?
Okay.
Well, the thing that's probably the most beneficial for increasing good cholesterol or increasing HDL is exercise. And, you know, from a diet standpoint, there are a few things that we'll talk about. But it seems to be if people smoke and they quit smoking and they start cardiovascular exercise or on a good cardiovascular program or aerobic exercise program, those things seem to have a big effect on HDL. HDL doesn't move nearly as much as LDL or the bad cholesterol typically. From a diet standpoint, you know, there certainly have been studies to indicate that alcohol has an effect on HDL, a good effect, positive effect. One drink a day for women if you already drink, and maybe up to two drinks a day for males, and it may increase HDL. And so it's really the alcohol. It's not necessarily that it's red wine or beer or what it is, but it's the fact that it's alcohol in the diet. So that can tend to have a positive effect too. And we do think that possibly changing the type of fat you take in the diet, adding more monounsaturated fat, more nuts, more seeds, more oils, maybe more omega-3 fatty acids may have a role in HDL, but that's not always proven to be true. And so that's another thing we can do that we know decreases cardiac risk level, is adding more good fats in the diet. It's almost as if you took your diet and you said, I'm going to take away things like chips and fries and things that are deep fat fried and baked goods that might have a lot of saturated fat and cookies and crackers, and try to take most of those away, but add in more almonds and walnuts and pistachios and nut butters, particularly natural nut butters and things like that. You really shift the fat, type of fat you take in. And that may play a role in the HDL and LDL level. So those might be some things that we think are most helpful. Many studies find that maybe LDL goes down by adding more fibers like oatmeal and barley and more fruits and vegetables and just eating a lower fat diet that's high in soluble fiber, but it may not affect HDL. And so I think the thing to focus on is how to get the LDL down. Decrease the saturated fat in your diet. Try to eat more good fats. Eat more fruits and vegetables, get more aerobic exercise, and then look at some of these things that may have even a bigger effect. You see all the studies on oatmeal and the ads on oatmeal, and it may not be a huge effect, but it might decrease lipids 5%. But if you're 220 and that brings you down, you know, a good, 10, 15 points or something like that, that's great. That's a help. And so maybe a cup of cooked oatmeal a day is beneficial with that. One of our listeners mentioned barley earlier. Barley is a great soluble fiber. It's a gummy fiber. Any kind of beans or peas. So many of my clients, when they work with me with cholesterol, we add more legumes and black beans and red beans and hummus and chickpeas and those kinds of things because they're gummy. and they tend to be helpful. From a fruit standpoint, maybe more apples and pears and some of these fruits that have a lot of soluble gummy fiber in them. So that's one thing you can do. We look at things like stanol esters or maybe other supplements that might be beneficial if you can't handle cholesterol-lowering medications like the stanol esters or maybe the red yeast extract and some things that some people can handle and they might also decrease it. But it's really going towards a heart-healthy diet of mostly plant-based, adding fish two or three times a week, particularly salmon, and finding ways to kind of get the balance of the good fats in there.
And working with your physician, with your cardio person, and maybe a dietitian.
Exactly. I think if – I always feel that – of course, I'm biased being a dietitian, but I think if you're really – if you're on any kind of medication for any kind of concern, health concern – of course, you want to be on the diet for that, too, because even for cholesterol reduction, many people will go on the medications, but they have no idea that if they just did a few things with their diet, that medication would work even better. And so we know with cholesterol, if you get it down 20 or 30 points or 40 points, but boy, you can get it down with diet another 20, that lowers your risk even more. So same thing with high blood pressure. There are things to do diet-wise that will work with your medication, even if you have to be on a medication. So.
Let's take another call. A listener in Sycamore, line 4. Good afternoon.
Yeah, hi. I was just wondering if you would comment on the antioxidant properties of unsweetened or semi-sweet chocolate. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay.
Well, that's a good one. you know, you've seen studies on chocolate, and I think one thing to keep in mind with chocolate is that the darker chocolate or the cocoa tends to have the best effect. So milk chocolate may not be that beneficial for us. It sure tastes good, but it might not have the same as many of the same properties or as strong a properties as the real dark chocolate. In studies that I've seen recently, they've used cocoa. So they've actually used the powdered cocoa, and that seems to be real effective. You don't have all the fat with the cocoa. So you might add a little sweetener to that, and you might make, a skim milk drink with cocoa and a sweetener or a little sugar, and that might be much better than actually having a lot of chocolate that has the cocoa butter in it. But we think from a standpoint of, you know, some of these types of antioxidants that would be in the same category would be, besides the cocoa, would be tea, the chocolate itself, again, maybe apples and grapes. And that's been looked at, of course, for cardiovascular risk reduction. That's really been the main thing that's been looked at. And just having, you know, a small amount, let's say an ounce of dark chocolate a day may be able to fit in your diet fine, but not really cause any problems and might decrease the risk of heart disease. And I think another food that I always think of along with chocolate is the Concord grapes or the purple grapes and the purple grape juice. There are some studies both with the chocolate and cocoa and the purple grapes that it may affect how pliable your arteries are. Or they do certain studies where they're looking at the blood pressure in the arm and the blood flow in the arm and actually seeing, well, are you getting better blood flow in your arteries if you have more of these foods? And that may be true, that certainly more of these antioxidants like the dark chocolate, the cocoa, the purple grapes, those kinds of things might increase blood flow. And now that we know for cardiovascular disease, it's not just about cholesterol, it's about the activity in the body and are you having decreased inflammation in your arteries and, better blood flow, that may be just as important.
Let's take another call now. A listener in Champaign on line 1. Hi.
Hi. Could you talk about the difference between soluble fiber and insoluble fiber?
Sure. Soluble fiber, I always think of that type of fiber as more gummy fiber. So if you think of something like oatmeal, and when you cook up oatmeal, and some people don't like it because it looks so gooey, that's actually good. That's soluble fiber, so it's that kind of
sticky?
Yeah, sticky, gummy fiber. Same thing again with barley. So you'd look at something like oatmeal, barley, beans, that same type of gumminess that they have. Many fruits and vegetables have soluble fiber in them. Those types of foods, from studies, tend to help regulate blood sugar. They can be helpful with blood cholesterol levels. When we think of blood cholesterol levels, those fibers can bind with some of the bile acids that form in your body and take those out of your system, which can lower blood cholesterol. And the soluble gummy fiber can actually help with diabetes, and we think it may help regulate blood sugars, tends to get digested more slowly, might be more beneficial that way. So those are foods that tend to be high in the soluble fiber. insoluble fiber is not necessarily the gummy fiber, but it's more the roughage. So if you think of whole wheat bread, we always say, gosh, have whole wheat bread instead of white bread. That wheat bran doesn't really form any gummy substance in your body necessarily. It just forms bulk in your stool. So when you get more bulk in your diet, that's good for your gut. That's good for your intestinal system. It's certainly good because we think it might lower the risk of cardiovascular disease. You might eat fewer calories if you have more bulk in your diet. So those would be things we might say like the whole wheat bread, whole grain cereals, things like fruits and vegetables will have insoluble fiber too and just add to the bulk of your diet. So that might be beneficial in terms of making us feel full, helping the gut health. Again, certainly playing a role in heart disease, we think, but might not necessarily be the cholesterol-lowering properties. So,
which do you think is best in terms of if you have tendency towards diarrhea?
Well, you might try both. Sometimes the gummy fibers tend to help you in that they might make your stool a little bit different. Whole grains themselves sometimes keep you more regular, and so the insoluble fiber might make you more regular, where the gummy fiber might actually help you if you have more diarrhea, that kind of thing. What I would do is I would do a trial, maybe try oatmeal every day and see how that, if that affects things at all, if you feel better with that. Sometimes a lot of fruits, because they have extra fructose, are not the best way to go, because that can actually cause some more loose stools and diarrhea and that kind of thing because of the fruit sugar. So it might be that you tend more towards vegetables and some of these gummy fibers and see if that helps.
Are there any fruits that tend to be more soluble?
Probably two of the most soluble, I would say, are apples and pears.
Ah.
So those might be two to try if you like those. Most fruits have some soluble fiber and some insoluble. They're generally, mostly kind of a mix with that. Sometimes what I find too, another food that I didn't mention that has some of the soluble fiber is flaxseed. So ground flax or flax meal. Sometimes when people have trouble either with constipation or regulating their bowels, sometimes adding flax, ground flax can be helpful with that too. So that might be something worth trying.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Let's move on now to a listener in Savoy on line two. Hi.
Hello. Before I get to my point, it sounds like you just said that fiber is good, whether it's soluble or insoluble. Did I get that right?
Yeah, it's good to have a mix of both. Typically, in a mixed diet, we get both soluble and insoluble fiber.
Okay. Well, I've begun to get concerned that some of this food additive or nutritional supplements and health food products and all these things are approaching the level of a subprime scam here or something. So I was talking to this medical doctor the other day, and she told me that most people do just fine with a balanced diet and maybe a one-a-day vitamin, and that all these 98% of everybody doesn't need anything more than a regular diet and maybe a one-a-day vitamin, which is they're very inexpensive compared to these fancy things. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think it's an individual case. I think the first thing we definitely want to do is maximize the diet because, as you mentioned, that's where the nutrients tend to be the best absorbed, the synergistic effect of getting the nutrients together. Many people can do really well nutritionally if they're eating five or six times a day. They're getting in a lot of fruits and vegetables. They're getting in their whole grains and having a balanced intake. So that's what we shoot for. We really shoot for that to be the base. And certainly adding maybe a multivitamin for your age and gender is a great idea. And for many people, that is the base of what they need. Sometimes when someone gets into a different concern, maybe they do have arthritis or they have high cholesterol, need to increase something else. It might be they increase more of a food product. That might be what benefits them. Or maybe, for example, if someone does need omega-3s, it's hard to get that in the diet, get enough of it, so that might be a supplement to use. So I think on a case-by-case basis, people can really utilize individual supplements if they need it, but it always should be the base of a balanced diet. Unfortunately, some people don't do that, but that's the best way to go, no question about it.
Yeah. I think these are 2% of the population. I think 98% of us will do just fine without any of these expensive things. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Let's squeeze in one more call. We'll have to be quick, though. Line 3, Urbana. Hi.
Hi. I just wondered if your guest has heard of lectin intolerance. Lectin, I think, is an amino acid. And I'll hang up and listen.
I don't think I've heard of lectin intolerance. But there, no, as far as I know, I haven't. That's something I will look up, though. And if it is an amino acid, it's one that might be an obscure one, not one of the main amino acids. But I will check that out. There are some new things coming around, some new concerns about different intolerances. Usually we think of an intolerance maybe to an amino acid, usually to a sugar, like a lactose or another type of sugar. And I know there's some concern about perhaps fructose intolerance and some other things. But I will check that out because I'm not familiar with it.
Okay, so maybe we'll talk about that come August,
mm-hmm.
First Monday in August. Registered dietitian Susan Kundrat joins us once a month, usually on the first Monday of the month, to talk about diet and nutrition. And here we have to wrap things up this afternoon. If you are interested in one of the things that we were talking about today, antioxidants, Susan has prepared a handout, Antioxidants and Exercise, and it lists all the great fruits and vegetables and other food items where you can find antioxidants and how to build them into your routine. So if you'd like a copy of this, just drop us a line at the Afternoon Magazine. Send us a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Afternoon Magazine, WILL Radio, 300 North Goodwin Avenue, Urbana, Illinois, 61801.